Alex, do you want to talk about art? Are you still loving film? Do you want to be shaped by film? Tell me, tell me, tell me.
I do. I still do.
Oh, good.
This is our part three of movies that shaped our love of film. This is Alex from Los Angeles.
This is Karen from San Francisco. Welcome to Movies That Shaped Us. We're two longtime friends who grew up on opposite ends of the globe with very different backgrounds, but were both shaped and are still being shaped by the movies we see and love. In each episode, we'll cover a topic around important people, places, events, and moments in our lives, and then explore it through three of our favorite films. Yeah, Alex, you already gave it away, but it sounds like we have something else to celebrate today.
Yeah, so this is actually our 50th episode. So we've
oh
been
my
doing.
Gosh, we are old.
We are old now. Yes, now we are entering our middle age as podcasters.
When did that happen?
I know. Yeah. Hopefully, listeners who've been following us from the beginning have noticed us improving over time. But maybe we're just the same as we were in episode
or
one.
Or more annoying for all you know.
Exactly. Or more annoying. Anyone who's stuck with us for these last 50 episodes, we definitely thank you for that. It's been a really fun journey, and I've really enjoyed learning about you, Karan, but also about these films. And it's been a lot of fun, these 50 episodes, and I can't wait for the next 50.
Me too.
So speaking of old episodes, it's actually the third episode we've done about movies that shaped our love of film. So we had the first time we did this, the first part was episode 7, and then episode 30 was part 2. So this has been an annual thing for us. It's basically each year thinking back on what are those seminal films that really opened up the world to film for us and made us cineasts and movie nerds and any label you want to put on it. So I have three more films that I'm going to talk about today, but just to remind listeners who might not have heard those other episodes, if you want to go back and listen to them, the other six films that I've talked about in the previous episodes are 2001 A Space Odyssey, Citizen Kane, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Unforgiven, Breathless, and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Karan, why don't you remind your listeners what your previous picks were?
That's a very good list. So mine were Notorious, A Place in the Sun, Brief Encounter, Volvere, Another Year, and Nashville.
Also a great list. These are all...
There's a lot about us, actually, just even looking at these lists.
Yeah, no, I think it shows our similarities and differences just looking back over these. And I'm sure these next three films we're about to go into as well are similar to that. So I guess remind listeners again, like what my framework is. You know, these are movies that I came across as I was developing my love for film, and they opened the doors to very specific other avenues and explorations of film that I later went on, but these were the three that sort of sparked additional journeys of my, you know, very wide explorations I've been doing ever since I was basically like a kid in terms of in film. So that's why I chose these three. And what was your technique in terms of picking these for this episode?
Same, I would say. The only thing I would add is, like in my previous list, these movies were also challenges for me. Like, these were not movies that I instantly watched in my first watch and felt like, oh, this is my new favorite movie. No, they pushed me. They were hard to watch. And I had to come back to them in some cases to maybe rediscover and sort of push my own knowledge and understanding of film to then come to appreciate them. So all of these movies on my list have been like that. And it's sort of funny looking back at the list of movies that I had on my list previously. Maybe this is true, right? Like, as you learn more, you want to take bigger challenges. So I think the difficulty and the of challenge with my movies has grown through these lists. So I think this list is probably the most challenging so far.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, it's interesting. For me, all these movies, the first time I saw them, I was like, this is like my not my favorite movie, but I immediately fell in love. And it was more around then immediately going out and learning about that film, watching it again, trying to like find more things that I love about it. And then again, opening doors to other avenues in terms of the art of film. But that's interesting that for you, this is films that pushed you. I like that. Yeah,
that's the thing, right? Like, it's not, there's obviously intrigue and draw and pull that you want to watch it. You want to learn more about it. Otherwise, these wouldn't be on the list. But the only subtle difference is that they were asking something from me. Mm-hmm. And I could see that my own knowledge of film and the aperture, if you will, was sort of widening.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
No, that's really cool. That is a good thing. Yeah, so then with that, Karan, why don't we kick off this list? What is your number three movie that shaped your love of film today?
All right. So my number three is Wings of Desire from 1987, directed by Wim Wenders, starring Bruno Ganz, Solvang Damartin, Otto Sander, and Peter Falk. Quick logline. An angel tires of his purely ethereal life of merely overseeing the human activity of Berlin's residents and longs for the tangible joys of physical existence when he falls in love with a mortal. So this movie came to me, I think, in that kind of critical period of movie watching. I want to say in 2015, 16 timeframe, okay. I think. You know, I don't think I'd watched that many foreign films at that point. Definitely not watched any German films for sure. I think my education of foreign films started with French films and Spanish films, like we've covered in the past on this list. So this was sort of a new challenge, but also a movie that is kind of poetic and black and white. And I think it definitely haunted me and pushed me. But I think the core of this movie, which resonated with me from the beginning and still does, is it poses some very hard questions about who we are as people and the full kind of spectrum of humanity, if you will. The sadness, the despair, and the joy in little things and all of that. And there's something about observing all of that in a bird's eye view kind of way is absolutely mesmerizing. And it's obviously done in a very poetic way. It's not lost that this is right after World War II. It's in Berlin. So it adds a lot more depth and weight to the significance of the movie. And then, of course, the way music and the technique of it all is used to you to kind of be put in this bird's eye view frame of mind is amazing, absolutely. So yeah, that's why this movie is on my list, because it's hard to classify this movie as a pure drama or a comedy or any of the typical genres that we know of. It's a poem, really, this movie, a haunting poem about life and humanity. But before I go any further, had you watched this movie before?
I had not watched it before. I'd heard of it because in the 90s, it was a famous Hollywood remake that I had not seen. Right. But City of Angels with Nicolas Cage and Meg Ryan and that Goo Goo Dolls song that was everywhere in 1990, whatever that was. Yeah. So I had known that at the time when that movie came out that it was based on some foreign film, but I didn't know what that was. And in the years since, I knew about the film, but I'd always wanted to see it. And it definitely, I think it's interesting when you mentioned at the beginning of the episode about challenging you and wanting to needing or feeling the need to kind of go back and continue to kind of unpack it. I thought the movie was very effective, but I also felt like there's more to this and I want to see it again. The things that definitely stood out were the incredible cinematography. So, you know, he is an angel for about 80% of the movie before he decides to become human. And the way that the camera sort of captures like this gliding bird's eye view of all these different lives going on in East and West Berlin, and the way that they weave in the sound of, you know, because the angels can hear people's thoughts and it's, so you're hearing people's thoughts and what they're thinking about their situations, and the camera glides in and out. And it's this POV, you know, sort of God's eye view, essentially, because they are angels too, that I just was blown away by how beautiful the cinematography was and the use of black and white. And then the switch to color, I thought was surprising. I was not expecting that either. It's like, oh, wow. Like it's color in the, when he becomes like the human perception is color, but the angels only see everything in black and white, which is interesting. Like I would think maybe it would be the opposite or something. Like the angels would have sort of more that they could see and the world would look, because they're seeing all these feelings. Like if you think it'd be more colorful potentially for the angels. So I actually liked how it was the opposite of that. Like you could sort of sense that these angels were sort of trapped in this world where they couldn't feel, even though they couldn't feel themselves, even though everyone else was feeling around them. I thought that was very effective too.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I was thinking about that too, but where I landed was that is sort of their desire, that they want more, you know?
The angels.
The angels, yeah. Because they can hear it, they can feel it. That part is heightened, but they can't touch it.
Right.
They can't kind of embody all these things, and that's why there's a distance, and that's why life for them is not in technicolor, because it's not everything. It's not real. In some ways, right? So the other kind of thing, that this movie can go so horribly wrong, right? In terms of, it can feel very cheesy and corny, and also kind of the poetry of it can just get boring and dull. But there's something about Wim Wenders, really, I think. And he's one of my favorite directors. I almost put Paris, Texas on this list, too, because I probably watched that not too long after this one.
Mm-hmm.
Again, an amazing film. But yeah, there's the calibration of this movie is so right, I think, because it pulls you, even though it pushes you. And at the end of it, I think what I come take away from this movie is that I felt a sense of joy in just kind of being human and the messiness of it all. Because when you're viewing all these people through an angel's frame of mind, yes, there's pain and suffering, but you also see how united everybody is in a way. Because everybody has those same kind of desires and wants for the most part. And that's quite humbling, actually, and a good reminder, especially in times of grave conflict and such that we are living through now. You know, the common people, for the most part, want similar things. And there's something kind of uniting about that, just seeing it literally from a bird's eye view. And then the other opposite part of that is that we as humans, we are often chasing the otherworldly. Or, you know, what if we were elevated to a higher plane or went to heaven or whatever we might believe in through our beliefs, that would save us or that would cure us of whatever problems we are dealing with. And it's funny to see that the people who are in that elevated plane actually want to be here.
Right.
Want to feel more and want all the messiness of life and navigate through that because there's something so innately special about that, just holding somebody who you love or being miserable because they've left you or, you know, sitting in agony in this area where atrocities were committed, whatever that might be, it's all real, it's tangible and nothing can replace that. So I don't know, I walked away from this movie the first time and I hadn't seen it in a while. Seeing it again, I just walked out feeling a sense of gratefulness and this kind of melancholic joy, which this movie has, but it doesn't lay it hard on you, which is the beauty of it.
Yeah, it definitely, when I was watching it and, you know, the angel, the main angel, he talks about what he wants. And I was like, okay, well now he's going to, and I remember the trailers from City of Angels and the Cage. So I sort of knew where the plot was going, but it happens so late in the film that they definitely really, I don't know, say like tease that out, but I was expecting that to be like, oh, the second act, he becomes a human. And then this is now the rest of the film, but they wait until like the last, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of the movie. It's like well into the third act. So they don't do like that decision. It's more about him desiring that than actually getting it and experiencing it, which I thought was very, what's the word I'm looking for? Restraint. The filmmaker has a lot of restraint to that, and that made the movie more powerful to me, actually. And the reason why I definitely want to go back on it too, which is what you were kind of touching on as well, there's a lot of layers in this movie because it does take place in Berlin, a divided Berlin. The wall was still up. There was not a hint that it would necessarily maybe come down. And there's a lot of flashbacks to World War II and talking to people that were survivors of that war, and then even allusions to the Holocaust and all these things. And that I was not expecting actually in this movie. And those are the layers where I'm like, wow, this movie's saying a lot and has a lot of things on its plate. And I want to go back and explore those other themes and not just that the main theme of, the angels and the desires of, you know, what them wanting to be human, right? That's the main plot, but there's all these other things going on that makes this movie very complex in a good way that I want to go back and re-examine those themes. You really do feel that you are in 1980s Berlin. Like I've never been to Berlin, and when I do go, obviously we'll be way after the wall came down and things like that. But I felt after watching this movie, I felt like I knew what it felt like to be there during that time, which is very affecting as well.
Totally transportive.
Yeah.
I guess a few more things to mention. I think Bruno Ganz's performance is absolutely incredible. That's the other thing that this movie totally falls apart if you don't believe him as this angel person. Mm-hmm. But there's subtle things of just his body language and the way he looks at people, the way he empathizes with the suffering, but also has this longing and desire for humanity, but also has this gravitas to him and kind of a larger than life sense around him, I think is amazing. And then the other kind of twist in the movie is Peter Falk, which is so cool. And the fact that he's playing himself and spoiler alert of people who haven't seen this movie, he's an ex-angel,
yeah,
which I think now that I'm thinking about this, again, credit to Wim Wenders, that you need some sense of humor and chuckle
right.
in this kind of a thing. Otherwise, uh-huh. it becomes too self-serious and almost loses you. And there's something funny that, yeah, it's Columbo,
yeah.
who's in Berlin shooting something and people recognize him. And, oh, it turns out that he's an ex-angel.
Yep.
It's just so comical, but in yeah. such a sweet kind of a way, which, I don't know. I had a smile throughout the scenes that he was on. It's so cool. Very
yeah,
cute,
I had no idea he was in the movie. And when he shows up at the beginning, I'm like, whoa, wait, what? He's in this? That's so random. And then when I found out, or as the movie goes on, I was like, wait, he's playing himself? That's even like weird. Like, this is weird, but like in a fun way. And I like Peter Falk. Like, he's cool. Yeah. So he does bring some levity to this movie, which very easily could be too self-serious and dour. But you know, I think that, again, the credit to the filmmakers, where they're adding in the right amount of, I don't want to say like comedy, because it is comedy, no. but it's not really, it's just levity. I guess that's a better word for it. The right amount of levity in the film.
Because it's, I think, trying to portray life, right? That through all the suffering in a place that's divided and there's so much misery around you, but there's also joy in the little stuff. Like the whole thing that with the girl who's this trapeze artist with whom Bruno Ganz's character falls in love, like her arc is so incredible, right? That there's these moments of wanting more and things not happening, but then also rediscovering the joy of what she does, even mm-hmm. though she knows this is not going to be that big. She still has camaraderie and community in her the troupe that she works with and all of that, but also has, you know, suicidal thoughts, which is this is what life is, you know. Mm-hmm. We're all kind of like that. One day could be better. The other just feels like, oh, when would all this end? It's just so amazing. And then the last thing I would say is that this is not a big budget movie by any chance. Like today, if you were to pen down that, oh, we're going to make a movie about angels and such, you would immediately think about special effects and all mm-hmm. sorts of things. This is an independent movie and it looks incredible, and you kind of already mentioned the cinematography and such up front, that it just proves over and over again that you don't need that much to make something compelling. If you know what you're doing and you have your head and heart in the right place, you can make it, which is great.
No, I agree. And just before we move on, have you seen City of Angels with Nicolas Cage?
I have, but I have no memory of it. I remember
you have
the Goo Goo
Dolls
song.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Goo Goo Dolls song, you can't escape. Oh, so you saw it when it came out.
Yeah. But I actually, for a long time, didn't even realize that this was a remake of this movie, because I had no awareness of this movie until, you know, much, much later.
Got it.
But maybe I should go and watch that movie again now.
Yeah, I've never seen it. And I was, after watching Wings of Desire, I was thinking, oh, should I watch City of Angels? I'm just sort of curious now on how they took this film and boiled it into something, which I bet he becomes human probably in the first 30 minutes. You know, I can see the Hollywood version of this story for sure, of how they can weave in more just four quadrant kind of, you know, turn it into like a tragic romance.
Probably
in some ways, probably what the tone is. But just curious. That's funny you'd seen it, but don't remember
it. I do remember some good friends of mine around me during college days, like swooning and kind of this movie becoming kind of a gateway into what falling in love might feel like and things like that. I remember vaguely having these conversations about this movie.
Power of the Goo Goo Dolls, you know.
Probably. So from angels and desires, what is your number three that shaped your love of film?
So my number three is A Better Tomorrow from 1986. This is a film directed and co-written by John Woo, starring Chow Yun-fat, Leslie Cheung, and Leung Ti. The IMDb plot summary: a reforming ex-gangster tries to reconcile with his estranged policeman brother, but the ties to his former gang are difficult to break. So I'll talk a little bit first about why this film is on my list, and then love to hear your thoughts on it, and then I'll kind of dive more into the film. But it's actually interesting talking about this right after we just talked about Wings of Desire, because the reason for me that this movie is on my list, which I saw this for the first time in high school, is it opened my eyes to the fact that foreign films were not always just art films like Wings of Desire. Or, I mean, at this time I had watched a lot of, like you said, two French films was sort of my introduction into foreign films, but these were all classic French New Wave, definitely art films, art house films, famous, like films versus movies is the way a lot of people, right, describe it. And this movie, which is a Hong Kong action film, is something where I realized after seeing this, wow, like foreign films can be genre films and can have the same types of experiences and emotions I get when watching a film out of Hollywood, but they come from another country. But then also at the same time, too, it sparked a lot of my interest in Asian cinema coming in through, you know, Hong Kong and John Woo, then got into films of Jet Li, Zhang Zhimu, and really all these different types of films from China and Japan that were not the typical like Kurosawa, you know, again, art house famous. I'm not knocking Kurosawa at all. Like, I love all those films. I love all these French films, and I like Wings of Desire, but I was opened my eyes to the international cinema was not just art house cinema. And I love this movie, which we'll get into, but I'm curious if you had seen this film before and what your reaction to it was.
Yeah, not seen this movie before. It's kind of fun to see where John Woo comes from and, you know, what got him started. And you can see how he's gotten even more stylized and I guess Hollywoodized as time went by. But the origins of what he's good at is there even in this movie. The other thing I would say, this movie felt so familiar to me because growing up in India and watching Bollywood films and especially movies from the 80s, like this plot line is just so typical of the movies that I grew up watching, and the fast cuts and so much information are just like, you know, glanced over quickly, and the melodrama of it, and of the relationships and everything. I mean, the only thing missing from this movie for it to be a Bollywood movie is the song and dance sequences. Like, you added those, this would be a Bollywood film. Like, everything. Like, to the point that I was watching it with my partner, and he was having trouble kind of, oh, what happened there? What happened there? I knew the plot the moment it started. Exactly. I knew who's who, who's what, what have you. It was so funny to me that this felt so familiar. And I didn't know that going in.
That's really fun. And I was actually really curious to hear your take, knowing that, again, growing up in not in the United States and watching films that were not Hollywood films, obviously they're not all going to be the Indian film that might be nominated for, you know, best foreign film. Like, that was sort of my perception of what foreign films were. There were these more heady, artsy. It was not just these action blockbusters. And not, again, I'll get into more of that. I think this movie's a lot more than just that. But this, I'm sure, was not as much of a I don't know, surprise is the right word, but I'm not surprised to hear that you feel so. This is, oh yeah, I've seen a billion films like this, especially now after going back and watching a lot more Indian cinema too, that is not just the films that are nominated for best picture or best foreign film. I'm like, oh yeah, no, there's all of this. There's some threads that are very, very similar on that whole like Southeast Asian action film. It's just, I can see that now. It's like, it's a very familiar kind of, the beats are familiar, the action set pieces are familiar. It's that's really funny to hear you say that.
I mean, we call them, I mean, there's maybe a little bit more violence in this movie than what I was used to growing up, but in general, we call these movies masala films. Masala is sort of like a spice mix, if you will. So there's a little bit of everything for everybody sort of thing. Action, and there's romance, there's melodrama, what have you. So, yeah.
That's fun. Well, so I came to this film, like I said, in high school, and I had watched Face Off, which is one of John Woo's Hollywood pictures. And I was like, this is the best movie I've ever seen. Like, I love Face Off, which maybe that'll come up in a future episode potentially. But I was like, where'd this guy come from? And then I went online, and this is like super early days in the internet, but there was still IMDb. And I was like, oh, he's like made a bunch of other films. And I was like, okay, what's like the most famous, best one to start with? And found some reviews said, oh, you got to start with Better Tomorrow. That was the beginning of his aesthetic and everything. So like, okay. And it was actually very hard for me to find the movie. I had to go to, there was not at the video store. There was not going to be a Blockbuster. And I went to actually through our library system in my hometown and found I could like order it through the library to get like the VHS copy of this. So it was tough to track down. I mean, it's funny to say this now. It's very easy to just go into Prime Video and search for A Better Tomorrow, and then boom, you can immediately watch it. But back then, these types of films were hard to find. So that sort of added another mystique to it. I'm like, oh, this is like, how am I going to get hold of this? And then I finally watched it and was just immediately blown away by, yes, the action. It's all the John Woo, you know, slow-mo action, gunshots being over-exaggerated. Like, when you fire a gun, it's almost like you're firing a cannon, and the people get thrown back against the wall, and there's a lot of squibs and blood sort of shooting out. And that was something that definitely was not the way American action films were, even in the 80s, which was sort of the height of that. It was definitely a lot more exaggerated. And, you know, a lot of John Woo's techniques of showing the person shooting and the person getting shot in the same shot. So you can see the cause and effect of violence, which is a big trope for him too. But there's also a lot of depth in this movie as well, which is something, again, it sounds like you are used to this because it was in Indian cinema, but in US action movies, the melodrama is not there. There's a very simple plot. You know, like in Die Hard, okay, Bruce Willis has to do this, but it's not all about these human relationships. And, you know, John Woo, one of his signature styles too, is male relationships, friendships, familial mm-hmm. relationships, things like that. And this movie is a lot about that. The two brothers, one's a cop, one's a criminal, how they're dealing with their relationship. And then Chow Yun-Fat as the friend, and they're all making these decisions in their lives. And where does that lead them? And then there's a flash forward of, you know, 7 years after a deal gone wrong, and where their lives are at, how they're coming back together. Like, all of this drama is something that I was not seeing in action movies at the time. And I think John Woo even brings that to a lot of his American films too, like Face Off, Mission Impossible 2, Broken Arrow. These all deal with like the duality of two men and how they're different, how they're the same, and how they go up against each other. And I just was, again, surprised to see all this in a movie that where I was expecting something just to be an action shoot 'em up. But I John Woo is one of my favorite directors, and this is sort of the beginning of that exploration too. I went off and then tracked down all the rest of his films. And then also too, Chow Yun-Fat is one of the coolest movie stars ever. And the beginning of this film, when he's there, and there's so they're counterfeiters is their the crimes right. that they're committing. And during the opening title sequence, they're showing like the criminals sort of showing up, and Chow Yun-Fat's one of them at the counterfeiting office. And there's this incredible shot where he lights his cigarette with like a burning like $100 bill, like counterfeit $100 bill. Mm-hmm. And just whenever the sunglasses, it's just like, oh my God, this guy's like the coolest guy ever. So in watching this movie too, I was like, who is this actor? Like, he's amazing. And I go back and find a bunch of old Chow Yun-Fat movies. But yeah, this is a lot of things for me. I mean, it's not my favorite John Woo, have to be the killer, but this is the one that kind of started my appreciation for international cinema that wasn't all just art films.
No, I totally get that. Yeah, it was a fun ride. Like I said, to me, this is just so familiar.
Right, right. It wasn't fresh and new to you. Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing except for, I guess, you know, the oozing blood and what have you. Mm-hmm. The one thing I was thinking about as you were just speaking is that this shows how global storytelling and cinema has become now, that this kind of action now feels mm-hmm. actually very Hollywood-y to me.
Oh, and definitely.
And it didn't. And it's probably because of people like John Woo and such operating here, where mm-hmm. these slow-mo shots, and I guess Tarantino brought a lot of this because he, I know, loves a lot of Asian cinema and such
and
as
John
well.
Woo,
so,
yeah.
So it's interesting that what felt maybe different maybe is not that different anymore.
That's totally true. That? Oh, yeah. I mean, I think definitely, especially in the 90s when John Woo did come to the States, but not only did they come to the States and he made some films in Hollywood, but for sure Hollywood action films completely cribbed his style and mm-hmm. brought it into mainstream Hollywood. I think now we've moved away from that. It's
true.
There was a period of time where the John Woo style action was really in, which was like mid to late 90s, maybe a little early 2000s. And now mm-hmm. we've moved away from that. But oh yeah, definitely he was very well known amongst, I mean, Quentin Tarantino, like you said, talks about him, you know, all the time of an influence on a lot of films that he made, and just especially like The Killer being like, oh my God, this movie's so great. And for sure, I think John Woo influenced a lot. And so you're right. It is, especially going back to this, you see putting this up against an American film, Hollywood film from 1986, and you see there's a stark contrast, but then you watch this film against an American film from 1996, action film. It's like, oh, this is the same. It's the same thing. So for sure, Hollywood absorbed the John Woo aesthetic and style for sure. I mean, he set the template for 90s action.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then on the, I guess, melodrama and the relationship aspect, I guess the other thing I would throw in there, which is also, I think, representative of Asia, or really anywhere, but more so Asia. So Asia is sort of the class conflict as well, right? Like mm-hmm. these are all people who are seeking more than what they have.
Right.
And that's sort of a big driver. And you kind of see those dynamics play in their relationship, especially when you fast forward 7 years, where the young intern protege guy is sort of now the head honcho
yeah.
and everybody else is elsewhere. And, you know, you want more from your life. And that's sort of what the driving force is anyway, which I guess is universal. But I don't know, I find that quite relatable in that sense of the kind of movies I grew up watching. The other thing I would say that maybe is not here, and sorry to make this about this movie versus like Bollywood films.
No, I think it's, I'd love to. Yeah, I love that comparison you're making. Yeah.
The other contrast, I suppose, is there's always like a predominant kind of familial parental character in these movies in Bollywood films, especially the mother character.
Oh.
And they didn't explore much of that. Like the father gets killed, spoiler alert, pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And you don't really find out much. And it sounded like he knows about what the older sibling has been up to because he asked the cop guy to kind of forgive him. Mm-hmm. But I would have loved to see a little bit more of that. Like there's not much sort of character development of, you know, depth. Like all the emotions are very much kind of on the surface versus I think... especially as a kid, what would pull me in is that, oh, because you knew that the mother went through all this and maybe she's a single mom or what have you. And this is why things are the way they are. And at some point, maybe the mother sort of becomes the pivotal tension point between the brothers because she's siding one over the other. In fact, there's this famous Bollywood movie from the 70s where it's this kind of similar plot. One brother is the cop and the other brother is this
criminal
head honcho Don kind of person. And he says, the Don guy is like, I have everything, you know, palaces and cars and what have you. What do you have? And he's like, I have mom.
Oh,
boom, mic drop. You know, that line is sort of like still is iconic in Indian cinema. So that's the stuff that this at some point, this stuff becomes surface level to me, I think, as much as I had a fun time. But I guess I'm more used to the melodrama even cooked further.
it's interesting you mentioned that because I'm going back in my head now and thinking about all the John Woo's films. And it is a lot about two men, friendships or brothers and how they're different or the same. But there's not a lot of at all sort of parents, mothers or fathers at all in his, like that must just not be
even
how
romantic
approaches
relationships. The poor girl has like nothing to do. Yeah. She's just like running around, you know?
Yeah. He's his characters and his movies and his, I guess his art is very much male dominated and again, male relationships and the women, there are some like in The Killer, there's a woman that he's trying to save or what have you, but it's more about the two killers relationships with each other than it is the woman. So I'm trying to even think, I wonder if that is a difference again between maybe Indian cinema and Chinese or Hong Kong, where they're more focused on brothers or men versus like parents and children. Because now that you say that too, in the Bollywood films that you put on this podcast so far that I've seen, the mother characters and that is that there's always some pivotal scene where the mom comes in and the parent and the children also seem very deferent to the parents. I'm like, okay, parents, what do I do? Like, even though there might be like 35, 40, they're still, the parents are still a major part of their lives and they lean on them for a lot of different ways. So I wonder if that's just a specific to India, just culture, which I find fascinating.
Definitely is. Yeah, for sure. Which I would think that a lot of Asian culture outside of the Indian subcontinent also has that. So it might just be
John Woo,
a John Woo thing that he's just not explored or not interested in that side. Which,
right. He's not. Great. So let's move on to your number two. What film is your number two film here, Karan?
Well, what a hard left turn. My number two is The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Yes, definitely a hard left turn.
From 1964, directed by Jacques Demy, starring Catherine Deneuve, Nino Castellanovo, and Vernon. Quick log line, a young woman separated from her lover by Boar faces a life-altering decision. You know, it's funny, growing up in Bollywood where every movie is a musical, in a way, song and dance and such has been very much part of my movie-watching experiences, movie-loving experiences. But I had not really watched a true blue musical until I was much older. And I'm discarding sort of Mary Poppins and Sound of Music. I mean sort of West Side Story or, you know, Hello Dolly or these kind of movies that are out and out musical. I came to them pretty late and Singing in the Rain. And, you know, some I love and some I don't. But I, of course, over time, I've come to love them more. But I think this movie, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, plays a critical role in my journey of just loving musicals or enjoying them or appreciating them for what they are. Because I didn't, even though I grew up watching musicals, I don't think I was an immediately someone who was immediately drawn to them in the Hollywood musical context, where everything and every dialogue is kind of sung, and you know, that's the storytelling is done through music. I love Singing in the Rain for sure, and it's, in fact, we covered that on my list way back when. But I think this movie really challenged me, because when I first watched it, the movie kind of gets into that right off the bat, where every line is going to be sung in the movie. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is what this is. We're really doing this. And made me very uncomfortable in the first, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And also because a lot of the singing is not great. And maybe it's because of the language difference as well. Not everybody is a great singer. But then at the same time, there's something that just kept me going with it. And by the end of it, I just was kind of totally awed by it, moved by it. And you kind of just, you know, give in, you surrender to that this is how this movie is and this is how the story is going to be told. And it becomes totally normal that this is, of course, how this world is. Of course, the bright colors and cinematography and beautiful people, Catherine Deneuve and Nino, all of it sort of just pulls you in this movie, and you're along for the ride. So, but yeah, before I go further, had you watched this movie before?
I had not seen it. For some reason, in the last, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, this movie sort of seems to be out there in the ether on like film Twitter and Letterboxd for some reason.
Greta Gerwig has been talking a lot about
this. Oh, is that
why?
For
Barbie. Okay. Like, this has been one of her inspirations.
Oh,
so
that's
that
why.
Could
okay.
Be a reason.
Yeah. So I that is actually the first time I'd heard of it, honestly. Oh. Like, it's sort of in the ether in the last. So I bet it's, you're right, it's totally Greta. And when it was on, when you put it on the list, I was like, okay, cool. You know, I people are talking about it, but I had no clue it was a musical. And it's not even really a musical. It's more like an opera in the sense of people are just sing-songing the dialogue. They're not actual musical numbers and songs.
Right.
And it's not like you could listen to the soundtrack and be like, oh, this is my favorite song. It's just every line of dialogue is just sing-songy sort of spoken, which very similar to you. I found it very off-putting and odd in the beginning. And I was like, wait a second. Oh, wow. This is actually like literally an opera now. The whole movie's going to be like this. And it kept a distance actually between me and the characters. Like, I couldn't get into the movie because of that, until it just gradually like pulls you in. And then by the end of the movie, I found it very effective. And I understood more of like what they were doing, what the intent of this was, which was this story, which is a very sad story, essentially about two people that fall in love, but because of the choices they make, basically decide not to be together, even though they might have, should have been together. And maybe they do still love each other at the end, even though they have now their own lives. So I was interpreting that, that the rest of the whole film to be like, it's basically a Hollywood musical without this Hollywood, it, quote unquote, Hollywood ending or Hollywood story. It's a, it's a story of a real life, what can happen and what your choices mean and the different things you do. And when you don't put love at the top of your priority list, what can happen, but told in a way that feels like it's a Technicolor musical from the 40s. And the song, they're not the song, that the sing-song dialogue, the incredible use of color and the sets and the gliding cameras. And it reminded me of a lot of Wes Anderson, too, in terms of symmetrical framing and movement of camera and very controlled, like, things in the environment. But the actual story is incredibly sad but and very true to life. And I like that there's that juxtaposition between what the story actually is and the way that they're telling it.
Yeah, it's such a whimsical way of telling the story that literally everybody sings.
Yeah.
But there's something so real and heartbreaking.
Yep.
You're totally right. And yeah, especially like when he has to go to war, like that scene, I was in tears watching it this time because we've been building up to this whole point and you see the love they share. There's something about, you know, sharing the love that they have for each other through music. And of course, you know, the beautiful setting of the place they're in, all of it, that it's heartbreaking when he leaves. But on the other hand, even though it is melodramatic in that sense, the performances are actually fairly deadpan because I think, and that's important, I think, because if they were emoting a lot more in addition to all the music and the singing, it would probably be unbearable. Like you have to almost sort of like, these people are vessels for the dialogue and the music.
Right.
It's not that they're, you know, not emoting at all, but it's fairly controlled for the most part.
Exactly.
Which I think is an interesting, once again, a very compelling and interesting way of telling the story. And you follow along, you know, that's the other thing, the universality of these emotions. You don't understand the language. You may even miss dialogues that are sung here and there, but you're totally with these people. You understand the mother's point of view, what she's trying to do. You understand the love of these people. You understand the situation with the guy and his aunt and the caretaker who's coming in to take care of her, all of it. And then, like you said, the final scene at this gas station and just the coldness of it, but also the vibrancy of it, how it's shot, is just absolutely heartbreaking. And she shows up there with her, you know, mink coat, and she has a better life and and has kids and everything. But it's a sad story, but it's also not sad in the sense that they both found different lives.
Correct.
And in a way, they found the dreams that they were looking for, just in a different manifestation. Like, he seems happy with this girl. And you know, the kid, he always wanted a gas station of his own.
Yep.
I don't think Catherine Deneuve fully knew what she wanted. Like, all she knew was love, and all she knew was to be with him. But I think based on her environment and her upbringing because of her mother, I think wanting a better life and access to more is something that she probably did want in a way, even though it's not fully expressed. And so, yeah, it's the complexities of life and also life kind of unfolding it to be what you want it to be, whether you know it or not, is kind of what I end up taking away from this.
Yeah, they both ended up happy, but just not happy together. And there is that acknowledgement, I think, in both those performances, that final scene where you can tell they're both sort of thinking about, oh, what would have happened if we had stayed together? Because they did have a love, but they chose not to pursue that. And they both ended up in other relationships, like you said, got everything that they wanted. But there's that sort of, what would have happened is still it's still a fun sort of thing to think about, I think, for these characters, even though they know that you can never go back and they're happy where they are. And that's the choice of the male to not see his daughter, because he left her pregnant and never met his own child. And she's out there in the car. He says, no, I don't need to see her, because that's not his life. You know, he has his own family now. He has his own life that he's in. A very, very true to life, I think. All the emotions of this movie, I felt, were very grounded and real and complex. And this is how life is, right? You make decisions and then you live with them and you hope that it turns out. And it did for both of them. But you still wonder, what if I made that other choice? Or what would have happened then? Would we have been just as happy? Maybe it wouldn't have worked out between these two people. You never know.
I think it wouldn't have, actually.
I mean, in terms of where they ended up, I mean, he, like you said, he always wanted the gas station. She didn't really seem to be that into that dream for him. And you're right. I think her poor upbringing, she wanted material wealth and she got it. And he would never have delivered that to her, because he just wanted to get his gas station going. So it's almost like it probably would not have worked, even though they did have genuine like love for each other. Love isn't the only thing,
right?
Is what this movie's trying to say. I mean, disagree with that or not, but I think that's what the movie's trying to say.
Or I would just contradict myself and say, maybe it would have worked, because maybe that's all you need and you make it work no matter what. Because that's the thing. There's something about the music and the singing and the heartbreak. It's not just, you know, young love that just fades away.
Right,
like
right.
Catherine Deneuve is like a shell of a person, as beautiful and perfect looking that she is. She's haunted by this love. Like this thing has changed her completely, which... Again, what better way to communicate that but song, you know, until you are comfortable with it.
Again, it took me like probably a half an hour to be like, okay, this actually literally is, they're singing, but it's not songs. It's sort of, again, an opera is the best way to describe it. But it sucked. It sucked me in, at least after that initial sort of like, wait a second, because I had no clue. And then definitely affected me to the end. So I'm glad you put this on the list. I definitely would go back to this film for sure in the future and found it very affecting. And again, I think there was some, as a fan of Wes Anderson, I did see a lot of him
That's a great
in this
parallel,
as an influence, even with the chapters Yeah. He does that a lot in his movies. And there's like a, you know, this is the summer months. Season and the months in this film. And I know he's influenced a lot by French cinema. And I wonder if he's ever talked about this film, but
I'm sure he has. I mean, this is kind of a classic inspiration piece for so many directors. Yeah. So I'm glad you liked it. Yeah. Once again, very transportive. I feel like with all of our movies so far, you're totally transported to these places and these people, people's lives. All right. What is your next movie that shaped your love of film?
So my number two is The Third Man from 1949. This is a film directed by Carol Reed, starring Joseph Cotten, Alida Valli, and Orson Welles. The plot summary: pulp novelist Holly Martins travels to shadowy post-war Vienna, only to find himself investigating the mysterious death of an old friend, Harry Lime. So this is a film for me that did sort of two things. I saw this again for the first time in high school, and it immediately, this was like my favorite movie, honestly, for several years of all time. I just immediately was entranced by this.
Oh, wow.
And it got me to deep dive into film noir, which is now one of my favorite genres, and also get deeper into just classic cinema from the 30s and 40s. So I'd seen, you know, the big major works of classic cinema, and obviously I'd seen Citizen Kane at this point. But Citizen Kane, as we talked about that in a previous episode on films that shape my love of film, Citizen Kane, even to this day, whenever I see it, feels like it was made yesterday. Like, it is the most modern. It's so modern. This movie feels like a movie that was made in 1949. It feels like a classic film. So sort of me embracing that and those aesthetics and what those, the pace of these movies and how they were put together and the acting styles helped me just be able to go and explore more of those films versus you see Kane and you watch another movie from that same year. It'll be nothing like Kane because there's nothing like Citizen Kane, but this movie helped me kind of explore more of that type of classic Hollywood, which is one of my favorite periods in film history. So I'll kind of pause there and I'll talk more about it, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are on this film and if you'd seen it before.
Yeah, I have seen it before. Absolutely loved it. And this is obviously one of those classic masterpieces, like you mentioned. I will say, though, that I guess my entry into film noir, from what I can remember, is through Hitchcock. So it's hard to, and then kind of obviously watching other movies of the 40s and such, you know, Gaslight or what have you, like Mildred Pierce and Sunset Boulevard. We've covered a lot of those movies on the podcast. The pacing of this one and the storytelling of this one does stand out for sure. And especially on this rewatch, obviously the cinematography and the mood of it is mesmerizing for
incredible.
Sure. There's nothing that can beat that. Like, I think this movie is a crowning achievement in that sense. I will say that the plot of it and maybe the acting styles of it and just like the pacing and the rhythm of it, that's the part that you have to be in the right headspace to kind of fully take it in, I think, as opposed to your other, you know, 40s noir film, which is maybe even corny at times, but there's something about that corn that you eat it up. Versus this movie, you have to sort of kind of give all of it, give all of yourself to it to fully enjoy it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a mystery where the whole movie, or not the whole movie, like 75% of it, Joseph Cotten's character is looking for his friend who may or may not be dead, trying to investigate his murder. So there's a mystery element that isn't as cut and dry as like, oh, there's a private eye. So a woman comes in, says, do this. And then he, you know, goes and tries to investigate what's going on. So it is a lot. It's just a different type of, film noir. It's a mood piece. And to your point on just the cinematography, I mean, that is what immediately like sucked me in. And even to this day, when I watch, especially the two scenes just really stand out to me. One is the initial reveal of Orson Welles in the film, because you think he might be dead. You know Orson Welles is in the movie. I'm like, where is he? When I saw this the first time, I was like, hey, wait, he's not the main character? This is crazy. It's Orson Welles. And then when he shows up as Harry Lime, he's in the shadows, and then there's a light that turns on.
Gasp.
And then all of a sudden, like, you see his face, and he has really, like, wry smile, and the camera zooms in, and then the light shuts off, and he disappears. And it's just one of the most amazing introductions to a character on screen is just incredible. And then the sequence when he goes, there's a famous chase in the sewers. Mm-hmm. And some of those shots, I'm still in, to this day, just in awe of, wow, like the just the lighting.
They do it?
Wow, it just looks so beautiful when you see this like long sort of dark corridor, but there's a light at the end and there's the shadows of people running around. And it just, even again, to this day, I'm just in awe of what that is. And that is classic, you know, film noir tropes. And not that this is at all the first film noir film. I mean, this, the genre had existed before this, but for me, it was my introduction into it. Because at this time, the Hitchcock films I were watching in high school were the classic, you know, Vertigo mm-hmm. and North by Northwest. I hadn't gone back yet to see the earlier Hitchcock, which he mm-hmm. dealt a lot of film noir. And that was not till college I was seeing those films. So this was like my film noir introduction, and my introduction more to loving the 30s and 40s and 50s mm-hmm. films. They're just and the score, I want to call that out too, just that zither score. I listen to it quite often. I have the soundtrack, and it's so great. I love the score to this movie. So unique too for that time, and it really puts you in a, speaking of transportive, you know, that time and place of post-war Vienna. I mean, they also intercut a lot of real footage mm-hmm. and they shot it there, and it's still right. There's rubble in the background. I mean, this is just right post-World War II. This was being made, and it feels like it. You really feel like amazing. You're in this shadowy, you don't really, there's no morality. There's all these gray areas. There's a lot of crime, that underground crime, and people are sort of okay with it, and all the different nations that were owning the different parts of the city. I mean, you really are mm-hmm. transported in the same way that Wings of Desire. I felt like, okay, now I feel like what Berlin is like in the 80s. I definitely feel like what Vienna is like in the 40s after yeah. watching this movie.
Totally agree. And I love kind of the cacophony of like languages and different kinds of people. It's, like you said, everything is in the gray. I love all of that. The score is very interesting. I'm curious, and I'm sure there's like volumes spoken and written about that. What do you think is the purpose of this score?
I think it captures the mood of the city in a positive way. Like it's very upbeat sort of zither music. And the rest of the movie is sort of showing Vienna as this, you know, broken city where there's all this crime and all these like post-World War II sort of morality kind of setting in. And I think what it does is remind people that this is one of the world's greatest cities, and there's still a lot of positive things in Vienna, and the city is still carrying on in the same way. It's not broken. It's still just the magical jewel of Europe that it was even before the war. I've not been to Vienna, but it looks like just a totally magical place. And for me, it's adding that layer in where, this is obviously, the city's gone through a lot. So is Europe, but there's still the, you know, the culture and the heart and the soul of the positive aspects of Vienna. And then you could also say like Europe as well, which was devastated after the war, but it's down, but wasn't out in that sense culturally. At least that's how I interpret that. But yeah, I'm sure there are, again, this movie is, I've read several books on this film, so I'm sure there's a lot of people that have their own opinions on that score, but that's at least what it represents to me. It's the contrast between the darkness of the story and the darkness of the actual film, because it is a film noir, but there's that levity there, which is, you know, the spirit of Vienna or something. That's how do you interpret it? And what did you think it was?
That makes sense, actually. I mean, it's obviously very fun and, you know, enjoyable, and I would listen to it on its own as well.
Yeah.
I did find it distracting.
Oh, really?
At times, because of the contrast of it. Because, you know, there is all this stuff happening. Somebody is dead, and mostly bad to great to bad things are happening throughout the movie, and the score almost makes you feel the other way. And at some point, the score is also kind of jovial and silly at times as well. And sometimes it's kind of heartwarming and fun, but sometimes it's also used as a device to increase the paranoia, because if it starts to play over and over again, it starts to kind of, you know, grate on you a little bit. And that also feels very purposeful. So I don't know. I almost feel like I want to watch it again, this movie, and pay more attention to the score as opposed to the cinematography, which is obviously the main thing you notice. Yeah. But this time, the score kind of unsettled me. But maybe that is the point, that it doesn't almost fit in the movie. This is not a fun movie, and the score is kind of opposite. But maybe you're right. That's probably one interpretation that is trying to underline the jewel and the joy of the city, what it used to be, or maybe what it can be, even after all that's happened. Or is it just there to kind of mess your head up a little bit? I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's a now I want to actually go and find some writings and analysis of the score now. I'm definitely gonna go do that after this. One other thing I actually want to call out too is that before I'd seen this movie, which again I saw this in high school, I think I just read about it, and oh, I know I was at the library just noticing the cover of the DVD. I'm like, Orson Welles, I'm just gonna get this and just rent it and watch it. But there was a cartoon in the 90s, spin-off of another cartoon Animaniacs called Pinky and the Brain. And there's an episode of this show that I remember is literally like a retelling of this whole movie, but for kids, essentially. Two, like a mice and a rat are sort of playing the two main roles. And it just, in a weird way, like I remember seeing this for the first time, be like, this feels like I've seen this movie before. Like something about it was like familiar to me. And then I realized like, oh my God, it was from this kid's cartoon. And it just did remind me of so much. And I think we actually talked about this on a previous episode where so many of these old like Warner Brothers cartoons, but this was from the 90s, even in the 90s, for kids would like use classic either film storylines, make allusions to them, or use parodies of different famous Hollywood actors and things. And it just sort of puts you in where you feel all these, this stuff feels more familiar, even though there's a movie that was made like 40 years ago. But as a kid, you're sort of absorbing it through these other kids' cartoons. And it's just something where I just wonder today if any these cartoons are doing things like this, because I think it's an important way to kind of get kids into film, or just familiar with these old stars or plot lines. Or I mean, literally is, I mean, you can, it's like 10 minutes. You can watch it on YouTube. It's the same basic plot of this, where like Pinky goes and tries to find the brain, who's the Orson Welles character. And it's in black and white. They're trying to crib all the, you know, the style of it. And it's just cool that that is sort of subconsciously my introduction to this movie was that cartoon. I didn't even realize until I saw the movie. I'm like, wait a second, this feels familiar. I just think that's a really cool thing that the animators were doing, again, even way back when with the Warner Brothers cartoons. Just a cool thing.
That's amazing. Now I want to go and check that out.
Yeah, it's funny. It's a fun little short. Okay, Karan, I think we're time for your number one now. What is your number one film that shaped your love of movies?
All right, so my number one is Broadcast News from 1987, directed by James L. Brooks, starring Holly Hunter, William Hurt, Albert Brooks. Quick logline: take two rival television reporters, one handsome, one talented, both male, and one producer, female, mix well and watch the sparks fly. Huh. Interesting logline. I have not seen loglines written like this before on IMDb.
Yeah, that sounds like it's the movie poster, doesn't it? Or like something that a narrator would say in the trailer. In a world.
Yeah, yeah. Very marketing-y.
Yeah.
As somebody who grew up watching and loving a lot of romantic comedies and romances and comedies in general, I came into watching this movie with those expectations initially. And those expectations were not initially met at all, because I was trying to force that expectation onto this movie, only to realize that, oh, this is actually really real. And these characters have a lot of baggage and drama. And these are driven people who are challenged by themselves, but also each other. And yes, it's a romantic comedy. I suppose you could classify it in that fashion, but
maybe.
But it's actually a very true life portrayal of relationships, and also what work means to us and how work defines us and how workplaces define our relationships. So it took a little bit for me to warm up to this movie, only to now say that I think this might be, for me, one of the perfect movies that exist. And it's sort of in that pantheon of movies that I think of, especially my kind of movies, which are about relationships and people and places and how people wrestle against each other, all of that. And this is a seminal movie for me in that sense. But yeah, curious if you'd watched this before. And if so, what did you think of it?
Yeah, I saw this for the first time. It was in college or right after college, just knowing that this is a not only like a popular film, but a revered film from the 80s. And I was like, okay, I'll rent it Netflix DVD by mail, and remembered being really impressed with what it was and really drawn into it. Actually, I hadn't seen it since then. And on this rewatch, it didn't hit me as much as it did the first time. Like, it fell a little bit in my eyes on this viewing, but I still think the movie is fantastic at what it's doing, because it does come with a lot of the trappings of, like you said, a romantic comedy, but there's so much more in this in terms of scope too. Like, I love the beginning where it starts with each of them as children, mm-hmm. and you can see, oh, okay, well, the little girl is definitely acting like a producer. So that makes sense that she goes off and is a producer, and the attractive anchor is just the dumb, cute kid who's not smart. And you can tell he's going to be the one getting by through his looks. And, you know, similarly with the other reporter too, like, he's sort of a nerd, basically, for lack of a better word. And then you track him through, you know, then there's this time period where you see what's going on in their lives. And then I love the coda at the end too, where you sort of flash forward and realize, yeah, these people went and lived their lives in the way that they wanted to. And they're all happy in their own ways. It's like it's a nice sort of arc of someone's life, where you're doing snapshots at the beginning and the end. And then there's sort of this period where it probably takes place over a couple weeks or months, maybe the actual meat of the film. I love that they're able to say so much about these people and their lives using that structure. I just find great. And the performances of all three of them are just so fantastic.
Oh my gosh. I mean, all three of them, but really James Brooks's writing and
the
way this movie is put together. I mean, there's so much to unpack here, right? Like, I've come very close to putting this movie in a bunch of work ethic or work related, you know, podcast episodes that we've done, but I restrained from that because I just felt like this movie deserved like a special mention. But that whole dimension of work and how work fuels people and how work is shown in the day-to-day, it's like an action movie to me, you know, mm-hmm. when Joan Cusack is like literally running over things to deliver the video footage and just the joy of putting that together and the excitement of it all of that is captured amazingly. But then mm-hmm. you kind of go one layer deeper, then it's about the ethics of the work that you do and what is a good story and who to believe and who not to. And I love that the movie subverts that. Like, in the beginning, like you were saying, the cute, good-looking guy, you think that he's good for nothing, but actually it turns out he is actually very good at what he does. I love that there isn't this kind of, you know, black or white thing to this movie in any shape or form. Mm-hmm. Like, Albert Brooks's character, who's the good friend who's supportive and there and she trusts him, he's kind of an a-hole as well.
Oh, he treats her terribly.
He's so terribly, he's very selfish.
Yeah.
And such. Meanwhile, William Hurt's character, who, yeah, it's a little bit oily and not truthful, at the same time, he knows exactly what the audience wants. And his love for Holly Hunter's character is genuine. He genuinely mm-hmm. thinks. And also, it's so hard to portray and write somebody who, to everybody else, feels really accomplished and good looking and what have you, but actually doubts himself.
Right.
And which is true for, I think, a lot of people. Like, you know, often you see interviews with actors or models or people who are considered to be attractive and successful, and sometimes you see an insecurity in them, and often I wonder that how real is that, or is that a performance, or and what have you. But sometimes you can see that, and you really see that in William Hurt's performance and this character, that, like, even in the end when everybody is they're having layoffs and such, and he is asked to go to London and be a reporter or whatever over there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's only until Albert Brooks calls it that you're actually being promoted.
Right.
He hadn't even realized that this is actually a promotion. So there's like so much nuance there. And then Holly Hunter's character, who's amazing at what she does, really takes everything so seriously, her colleagues, her relationships, but is also somebody who's often getting in her own way all the time, it's so difficult for her to let go and bring people in. It's just such a, I don't know, the complexities of human life, they're all on display. It's messy. And I think that's why this movie first hit me like a ton of bricks, not in a good way, perhaps, because when I saw her sitting in the room, like crying and disconnecting the telephone, and I was like, what is happening? Like, what is the pacing of
this
movie?
That's like the intro to her character, other than her as a child. Yeah.
And I was like, this is so strange. And then, of course, as the movie builds, you understand and you see all of it. So, yeah, I could go on and on about this movie and its writing and how it's put together. It's kind of genius, I think.
It definitely is. And maybe it was because we were recording this episode so soon after the work ethic episode that we did. But I saw it through the lens this time I watched it around a lot like work. Like, these are three people mm-hmm. that are very, very good at what they do, but they're all unhappy in their own ways through the bulk of the film. And then at the end of the movie, when they have the coda and they sort of meet up a couple years later, you realize that, you know, Albert Brooks's character basically chose his family over the work. He left the, you know, the Washington, D.C., goes to some office in Portland. He's like, yeah, you know, my career doesn't need to give me joy. Like, I want a family. He has a son. And that is really what's important to him in his life. And Hurt clearly went the other direction. Like, he chose his career and that he's at the top of his game. You can tell his wife almost feels like a arm candy only. Like, they don't really have a deep relationship, but he doesn't need it. Like, he's getting all what he needs out of his career. And then Holly Hunter, I think, represents someone who can do both. Like, she found that balance between, she's dating, she said, there's someone in her life, but she still is a very successful producer. She didn't give up on those dreams, but she was able to balance her life out better. And I was like, this is cool. Like, and they're all happy. There's not a judgment the movie saying, oh, William Hurt's bad because he chose work. And it's like, no, this is just people in their lives make choices about what makes them happy. And each of them found that through their relationships with each other and then the events that unfold in the main meat of the story. And you love that. The ending is so sweet in the sense of these are three people that, yes, they went through some troubles and tribulations, and there's a love triangle aspect of the film too, and all this, what have you, but they're all happy in their own ways at the end. And you're like, oh, this is great. You see these people from their kid. So you feel a little invested. You see them as children. And you're like, wow, this is great to see. They've all found happiness in their own ways through the prism of how they relate with work.
Yeah, but it's also not so tied in a bow either, because there's longing. There is that feeling of what could have been, you know, from both the men ended up with her.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like with life, they're also unfulfilled dreams. Like, you can see that glimmer in Albert Brooks's eyes that, oh, if I had stayed on the path that I was on, would I have been more successful? Would I have been happier in that sense? Did I settle? Same goes for Holly Hunter, that, yeah, she's successful, but there's that thing that these people are actually more settled in a way, especially Albert Brooks, who is married and has a child, Holly Hunter is still dating just on the process. And for a woman, that's like a different thing, you know, the pressures of society and whatever you put on yourself, what have you. So, yeah, there's a lot of like glass half full, glass half empty kind of thing. Also, I'm sure you know this, that there's a different ending that was shot.
I didn't know that. Enlighten me and the listeners. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So basically, if I'm remembering it correctly, so there's this whole scene where she and William Hurt are supposed to go off on a holiday after the layoffs and everything. And that's when she finds out, thanks to Albert Brooks, that William Hurt's character had been disingenuous in creating that news report segment that he had produced about this rape victim or abuse victim person, and, you know, the tears in the eyes of William Hurt and such. And that really rubbed her the wrong way. So she shows up at the airport only to tell him that she's not going to come with him, and then gets in the cab to leave him.
Right.
And the alternate ending was that I think she goes back in and they end up together or something like that. Or he comes back out, but they are together is sort of what the original ending was. But I actually love what they did.
Me too.
There is this sense of kind of this lived, like, awkwardness and livedness in the three of them hanging out with Albert Brooks' son, who, by the way, looks exactly like him.
Yeah, I don't know
where they
casting.
Found this kid. It's hilarious to me.
Yeah.
So I love what they did with that. Because again, like I was saying, it's about the messiness of life. I don't think any of these people could have gotten together. Maybe they could have. I don't know. But this feels right to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right in that there's a sense of, well, what could have been, but those are not desires. They're just thoughts, because all of them are happy in their lives. They're, you know, you have, sometimes you think back, oh, what if I'd done this? But you're not like guilt-ridden, like, oh, I should have made this choice, or regret, or, oh my God, my life is, they all seem very happy with where they are. And again, that's what I like about that ending so much. And that definitely would have ruined a lot of the film. I mean, what I think is actually, this time I saw it, I was questioning, like, why does she care so much about him faking in that tear as I was watching the movie? And then I sort of at the end, I was remembering, like, yeah, like she was crying throughout the movie. And that was her way of showing genuine emotion, was her tears all the time throughout the film. There's multiple moments, like you said in the beginning, where she unplugs the phone and cries. She cries to herself at multiple moments in this film because that is the way that she releases. So to her, tears are a very important expression of truth and her, what she's feeling. And for him to fake a tear to get sympathy from an audience for this news segment is a bigger betrayal than, you know, I would be like, okay, fine. Like, you're faking a news story. Like, that happens, or not faking it. The news story is real, but you're faking your reaction. I mean, this happens all the time in media and has forever and will continue to do it. Like, it wouldn't bother me if I found that out from him. Like, that's not a deal breaker. But then at the end of the film, I realized, oh, for her, like the crying, that act is very, very sacred to her because of what she's been doing throughout that film. So that is a bigger betrayal than it would be just to, you know, to a normal person. Like, oh, you're crying. Like, okay, fine, whatever. Like, you're making the piece more interesting.
I didn't read it that way. I don't think she's even aware that crying to her is sort of, you know, precious to her. To me, this is more about her work ethic, I think. That for her, the purity and the truth of storytelling is so important. Like, even when he shows her the segment, and he's like, did you like it? And people are crying in the room. And she's like, if it's effective, not what I would have done, because it's too showy and there's no need to show you. It's about the story. She says that right up front.
She does.
She's very clear that this is just not authentic, true storytelling. And that sort of is the central conflict of the movie, where Albert Brooks and Holly Hunter, they're all about the purity of truth and all of that, versus this guy is all about the audience and what sells. And that's the central conflict, essentially. So yeah, that to me, that's what I take from that.
Yeah, maybe it's just the age we live in now. If anyone was like,
I know.
It's like, what are you, crazy? Like,
this is,
of course you have to.
Now.
Yeah, this is, but news has always been like this. You have to put some little spin on it, because the point of news is to inform someone, and you want to think of your audience. Getting back to the film again, even though it did, I had it sort of higher on my reverence for it on this watch. It fell a little, but it still is just it's a masterwork and a film that is very hard to put into a box of like what it really is. It's just a story of three people and their lives and what happens. You can say it's a romantic comedy. There's actually a lot of, I love the scenes where the composers are trying to come up with a theme song for the news.
Oh, good.
And they use that again during the closing credits. But those scenes, I was like laughing.
Hilarious.
They're so funny. But yet there's also scenes in this movie that are just like really hard, not hard to watch, but like very emotionally powerful. Like when Albert Brooks and her are having that argument where he's basically saying, I love you, why are you going to this guy? And saying horrible and mean things to her. But it's a very, very truthful. I felt that scene was very truthful. So this movie, you can't really put in a genre box. I think it's just, that's broadcast news. That's all you can really say. This is just broadcast news.
It's life film, you know?
Yeah, life. That's, yeah, right. It's life. Yeah.
To me, I mean, the whole thing of when Albert Brooks decides to be the anchor of the news show.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And he's sweating.
Sweating
and just,
bullets.
Yeah.
The whole sign of the news behind is like dangling and moving and
yeah.
Towel rolls and all of it. And then his reaction when she comes back from the White
date.
House correspondents dinner and he's just like laughing because I find that so relatable when something has gone so bad that all you can do is just laugh. And he's like, well, at least I lost, you know, 40 pounds.
Yeah.
And
yeah, in sweat.
People
were
calling in for my well-being. Like, it's just, again, so hilarious and heartbreaking all at the same time. So what made this movie come down a little bit for you?
I don't know. I guess in my memory of it was more of like, oh, this is like a you know, five-star film was in my memory. And then I watched, I was like, yeah, this is, it's very good, but it just didn't hit me the same way. So I can't explain it other than that. I think maybe my memory of it was that it was a much more effective, or maybe when I saw it at that time as like a 20-something-year-old, it just hit me a lot harder than it does now as a as an older guy. I don't know, but I still I'm not saying the film I didn't like it at all. I just it was like a 5-star film in my memory, and now it's more like a 3.5 or something.
It's interesting. Yeah, to me, like, this movie just grows as I grow older. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like the opposite.
Yeah.
Which we've actually noted several times on this podcast.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
This happens with us. Okay, so that was broadcast news, my number one. What is your number one, Alex?
So my number one film that shaped my love of film is A Clockwork Orange from 1971. This is a film directed and co-written by Stanley Kubrick, starring Malcolm McDowell, Patrick McGee, Michael Bates, and David Prowse. IMDb plot summary. In the future, a sadistic gang leader is imprisoned and volunteers for a conduct aversion experiment, but it doesn't go as planned. So this film for me, I've already included another Kubrick film, 2001, when we did our first episode. And that probably either 2001 or Dr. Strangelove, I think, were the Kubrick films I probably saw the first time. Like, the first film of his were probably one of those two, because I saw it very young. Like, my dad was like, you got to watch these movies. And I mm-hmm. watched them. But this was the film that I saw when I was a little older. I was a teenager. And it just immediately I was like, oh my God. Like, this for a while was my favorite film of all time. And this started my real actual obsession with Stanley Kubrick that really just opened up my whole world to film in terms of my deep dive in his filmography, understanding what directors do, like reading so many works and analyses of his films, seeing all of his films like at least a dozen times. Like, I'll rewatch his films over and over. And it was this one that really, like, again, I think it was right place, right time, potentially right film in terms of the age I was and seeing this. It just hit me. And then every time I watch it, it just, I see different things in it. Like, you know, for me now, just as someone who's not a teenager anymore, the humor comes across so much more strongly than it did when I first saw this at like 15. I think this movie is absolutely hilarious from start to finish. I think that's a lot of what Kubrick does in his sense of humor. But I'll pause there and talk more about the film in a second. But curious what your relationship to A Clockwork Orange is.
Yeah, I saw it before. I think I saw it in my late 20s or early 30s. So kind of in that time when I was kind of falling in love with film in a bigger way and such. And kind of brutal watch, but at the same time blew me away. Had not seen it since. This is not the movie that I would put on to as a casual Thursday night viewing for sure. It's brutal. It's, you know, depressing and all of it. At the same time, watching it again this time, of course, you marvel at, you know, Kubrick and all of his artistry. There's no question about that. But I don't know. I'm so curious to hear you talk more about this, that it's almost like he is playing with you, which is the meta text of the movie as well, that this is all horrific and brutal, but you can't look away. At the same time, you're titillated, you're also annoyed, you're angry, you're frustrated. All those emotions are being brought out from you, that you want to run away from this, but you also can't look away from it and you want to stay there. It's just such a all-encompassing experience, which is why it's such a hard watch for me. But I can see the humor, obviously, and I can see the artistry, and with many more watches, like, maybe this movie softens that it becomes quote unquote enjoyable, but it's quite sick, actually.
It is. I mean, it was banned in the UK for like 20 years. You couldn't even watch it. And it is based on a book. So this is not just Kubrick, which I did read the book later in high school and really loved the book too. But yeah, I mean, that's where, when I first saw it, I think, again, as a teenager, the shock value attracted me to it. Cause like, as a 14-year-old guy, you want to kind of get shocked and like, oh my God, they're putting this on screen. There's so much sexual violence and nudity. And you know, there's an allure to that, I think, as a teenager for sure. And that I think is a big reason why I became immediately like drawn to this, like this, cause it feels, again, something like you shouldn't really be watching, because there are so many very difficult things in the film that is treated not as, it's sort of just there. Like, you see a woman being sexually assaulted in like the first 10 minutes and the film doesn't judge it. There's not like, oh, this is terrible. Look how horrible this is. It's just like, oh yeah, this is happening and this is the world. And that makes it kind of hard to stomach. And over time, it's like the humor for me comes across so much more now, where I do find enjoyment. I mean, the shock value is worn off for me. I mean, yeah, I've seen it, I don't know, 15, 20 times over the course of my life, at least. And it's, again, the older I get, the more I sort of look at all of Kubrick's films now as comedies. He finds these weird sort of dark humor in so many different things. I mean, even the juxtaposition in that scene I just mentioned where there is the sexual assault, a gang is basically like assaulting this woman in a theater. And the shot starts with a picture, or the camera's on the ceiling. It's this very ornate, beautiful, like Renaissance kind of painting. And there's classical music playing, and the camera just pulls down, it pans down. And now there's like a sexual assault happening on screen. And the juxtaposition between that high art, both on the soundtrack and with the background of that theater that they're assaulting her in, against the violence. I find that funny somehow. Like the little angels are sort of like watching down and looking at that. Like, I don't know. I just, that is funny. You know, there's obviously like things that are definitely meant humor when he's checking into the prison, and there's got that super British guy being like, you sign here and do this and like take this off and do this. And it's all like following rules. And I find that hilarious too. But and actually even the conceit of the film, and even though, yeah, it is very a dark subject matter in the sense of what he ends up doing is going to the scientists are trying to really deprogram him from violence. And I don't know, there's something about that just comes across as funny to me in terms of what they got his eyes like pulled open. And yeah, there's a horrific aspect to it too, obviously, when he's forced to watch all these violent images as they're giving him these drugs so that when he sees violence or thinks about sex or violence, he gets sick. They're trying to deprogram him. I don't know, something about that is just like silly. And actually too, I think another message of this film that I find fascinating is it is a triumph of the human spirit in a way, but through violence and sex, in the sense of they're trying to remove these feelings from him, but they can't in the end. And mm-hmm. It's like, you know, science is trying to remove human nature. And normally you might think human nature in a film or a story or a book or something would be like all these good things about being human, like love and, you know, compassion. But this is, you know, he's a teenager and he's a guy. So it's like sex and violence is what his human nature is. And they try to get it out of him, but they can't. And in the end, they reverse the treatment. And now like his, you know, he's all the sympathies of the nation are like, oh, it's so bad what we did this kid. And the very last line of the movie is like, you know, yeah, I was cured. All right. As he's having these visions of him, like with a woman in this field. So I don't know. There's something about that is, again, it's like normally you would think love would be what the human condition that we're trying to save. But actually it's sex and violence. And I find that funny in a way, too, because that is part of what it is to be human. Like we have these violent desires and these sexual desires and these love desires and all these things. And the fact that, again, I'm not crediting Kubrick for this because this came from the book, but using that, I don't know. I just find maybe it's a dark humor or something, or the irony of that is funny to me. Like, yeah, he's cured, quote unquote, but back to what, you know, the normal crazy teenager that he was. I just find that funny. I don't know. It's funny to me.
I get the dark humor part. I wouldn't call it funny because it's quite disturbing across the board.
Yeah.
And maybe you have been deprogrammed now by watching this movie like a million times.
Yeah, I mean, I said that.
Perhaps.
Yeah. No. I understand if you've only seen it twice, or it was, you know, listeners have maybe only seen it once, or you haven't seen it, now you're going to watch it. I think the first time does hit different because it is something, even now, like this movie came out 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and it still is like, whoa, like they put this on screen. Like the main character commits multiple rapes in the first 20 minutes and you're following him and have sympathy for him throughout this film. And it's
brutal, but it's complicated for sure. Like you're totally right. Like these desires and these are all part of humanity for sure. Yeah, there's something about the triumph of this human spirit, but it's, I guess funny could be one way to look at it, but to me, it's also kind of sad in a way that our vices and the things that are bad in us, no matter what you try to do, it's so hard to overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
So tomorrow, this guy is going to go out and just commit more atrocities and assaults and have, you know, wreak havoc on society and such, and in some ways that making that laughable or funny is also not right, but at the same time it's also kind of true in a way, because these things are all in us. And this is why I guess the slightly futuristic setting of the movie, even though it all feels like very 60s. And I mean, the movie sort of feels timeless in that sense because of where it's set. It could be any time, anywhere. It doesn't matter. But it's still removed enough that it feels a little bit unreal, which helps, I think, to kind of stomach the gross reality of and the ugliness of the human spirit, I suppose, that this is not going to go away easily.
Right. And again, Stanley Kubrick is my favorite director of all time. And I disagree with him on, I think, a statement that he makes in almost every single one of his films, that violence is human nature and that is our natural state. And I just disagree with that, like at a philosophical level. I don't think that that is what makes us human. But that clearly is Stanley Kubrick's position, because so many of his movies bring that topic up, play around with that. And this is definitely one of them. And in fact, the book, which I also really like a lot too, had a final chapter that was removed that they eventually brought back, because it was like a banned chapter, that it flashes forward to Alex, who's the name of the main character, basically like a young adult now, sort of looking back and like, yeah, I was a crazy kid. I was a teenager. It was a phase I was going through. And now like I'm an adult now and everything, like what a wild, crazy time it was, sort of to say that I think that what the author was trying to say there is, yeah, like people can, and as a teenager, you go through these phases, but that doesn't mean you're a bad person overall in your entire life. And I think that the reason why potentially it was removed, and I haven't read a lot about this, so maybe I'm wrong, if literary experts can correct me, but it's almost like a excusing, essentially, like what he was doing in that film, that he's actually not a bad guy. It's just part of being human is you play around with sex and violence sometimes in certain parts of your life, especially as a teenager, and then eventually you kind of grow out of it. And this was a chapter, I think, that was banned because of it, sort of, again, is maybe even more excusing what he did. And again, the chapter was not around when Kubrick made the film. So he ended it with, Alex just going back to his, his normal, at least the desires he had were back to normal. But yeah, it's obviously playing around with a lot of very interesting concepts and things about what it means to be human, which is another reason why, again, I think this movie talks about a lot of different things. And that is one that I find interesting, and another reason why I come back to this film a lot.
Yeah. And the other thing I noticed in this watch was in the scenes when he's, basically traumatizing the world around him, his friends and everybody, really, he seems such a grown up in that white outfit. But then when you see him otherwise, he's kind of a kid, which is so kind of jarring to realize that, all the horrible things this person is doing, like, you're just a child.
Yeah.
That you're doing all of this, which is as like another layer of horror. This is not a grown person, which once again kind of underlines maybe what you just said about Kubrick, is that he believes that if violence and bad things are sort of who we are as humanity, there's no age to that. You can start pretty early, basically, doing horrible things. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And removing those desires, which is what they put him through in this film, is actually anti-human. It was anti-human too. Like, you're ruining the human condition by preventing Alex from thinking and having these, violent and sexual desires, which, is also, I think, a very important message of the film too, that Priest is mentioning to him when he's in prison, that goodness and being good is a choice you make. If you force somebody to be good by, again, the Clockwork Orange sort of means like mechanical and organic matter put together, right? So you're taking away that choice, and that choice makes us human. You choose, like, I choose not to be violent.
Yeah.
And if I was forced to not be violent, then that's the different thing.
It's gonna have the opposite impact, which we see.
Exactly. And I think that message, I like that message of the film, that goodness is a choice, and you want people to make the right choice, but you can't take that choice away from them, because then they're not human anymore. I do believe in that. I think that is true. And I like that scene that he has with that priest. But I still love this film. I love the score. I love all the Beethoven, the synth Beethoven. I think Wendy Carlos did a fantastic job. I listened to the score a lot, even though, it plays during very horrible things that going on the screen. But I also love that juxtaposition, which is another message of the movie too, which is that this kid who is so awful and doing such horrible things, he loves Beethoven.
Right.
So it's sort of, again, saying, just because it's this high art and classical music doesn't mean that horrible people can't love it.
Absolutely right. And
means
in
nothing.
some ways, like this movie is in our current culture of, you know, cancel culture and where there's judgment on everything that somebody does. Like this movie is basically like a slap in the face.
Yeah.
It's an assault to sort of all of that, kind of just saying that this is how humanity is. It's all its in all its ugliness and some glory, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sprinkled here and there.
Yeah.
And have at it. From that point of view, like it's, yeah, it's still, it's, it was and will always be daring because it's just, and that's what I said in the beginning, that you want to look away from this, but you can't look away because it sort of teases out the ugliness that we all have in us.
Yeah.
You know, to varying degree. And it sort of rips that apart and puts it on screen.
And I think that's also what the film's playing with too, in the sense of you, again, are enjoying watching something that's terrible. So aren't like, are you somehow
you're
complicit
culpable.
In something? Like you're
exactly.
culpable. You have those desires, even though you're not acting on them, you still like watching this on screen. So what do you think about that audience? Like, I think
this
there's that layer
said, it's
to
very
it too.
Sick.
Yeah,
this is a sick person's,
it is. Yeah.
You know, I'll just, I guess, say it like as true as it is, it's a sick person's thing, but I guess you can argue you need that in the world as well to kind of push that button and make us aware so that then we don't make that choice. There is a part of me that sort of is horrified that what if somebody looks at this and feels like, oh, look how cool that is. Because the way Alex and his merry men are portrayed, they're also kind of cool in a way.
Totally.
You know? And that's the part which I know has sort of been a long running argument through cinema is that, if, you know, cool people are doing horrible things, does that kind of justify it and make it even attractive? And which I guess is another dimension to the movie that you have to wrestle with that and make that choice.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the movie was banned in the UK
right.
for decades, because they were worried that this would cause kids to go out and do the same things that Alex was doing in the film. And, you know, personally, I don't believe there's any connection between violence on screen and violence in the real world. I think those things are completely separate and there's no correlation between those two. That's just my opinion. There's no correlation between those two things. And it's a silly argument to make. And we have other issues in society that cause violence, not movies. But that this movie obviously is about that too, right? Like it is, because it is portraying, I mean, people dress up as these, the Droogs, which is a gang's name for Halloween. Like it's a popular Halloween costume. It's an aesthetic that, especially as a teenager, again, this feels like something you're not supposed to watch. So there's a phase that, you know, I know a lot of people sort of go through where like they watch this movie when they're like 14 or 15 and like, oh, it's so cool. They love it. Obviously they're not going out there and then committing acts of violence, but it is like a tantalizing thing because you shouldn't like this, but you do. And it's like, then you have to kind of wrestle with that. And that intrigues me. It's another reason why I like coming back to this film, because I like that challenge of like, I shouldn't like this guy. He's doing horrible things, but you do kind of feel bad for him at the end of the movie when he's getting, you know, used by all the different political parties and things. And that treatment was terrible. And
barely.
It just, oh, well, I feel bad for him. I mean, I think that could be Malcolm McDowell's performance too. Yeah. So that was our third episode covering the movies that shaped our love of movies. I love these episodes a lot. I think hopefully listeners do as well, because there will be a fourth one next year. We'll do this definitely again and talk about more of these films. And speaking of next time and what's coming up, what should you tell the listeners what our next filmmaker we're covering, and then what is our next full episode?
Yeah. So the filmmaker we are going to be covering is David Fincher, which I think is a good follow-up to Kubrick, who also likes to deal with the ugly side of humanity with perfection. So that's coming up next, and it's in honor of his new movie, The Killer, that's going to be showing up on Netflix very soon. And then our full episode is going to be movies that shaped our love of sharing a meal, because we are getting into the holiday time. So excited to talk about that.
Yeah, that'll be, both episodes will be fun. I think maybe one a little more darker than, you know, and twisted than the other, but definitely will both be very fun. So I hope everyone enjoyed our discussion today. We're available on all major podcast platforms. Make sure to leave us a rating, a review. That definitely helps us be found in the algorithm. Also a reminder that we have a YouTube channel where you can look at all of our specific individual film reviews for all the movies we've covered, all up there. So until next time, talk to you later on.
Bye, Alex. Hope you all enjoyed this episode, and we will see you next time.